I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most, and they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, "We see you and we've got you." Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
Welcome to ABG, Asian Boss Girl, a podcast for the modern day Asian American woman. My name is Helen.
I'm Janet.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Yvette.
On today's episode, we are going to explore a topic that I have personally been very interested in. I've shared on our podcast that I have struggled with my relationship with alcohol for some time now, and I'm currently doing well and successfully employing a method of moderation, but there have definitely been periods where I had a rather toxic relationship with alcohol, and I continue to be interested in actively understanding and managing this relationship.
The topic of addiction is also rather taboo in Asian culture, so it is often unaddressed and misunderstood. Many people are unaware, uneducated, unprepared, and suffer alone. Research found that Asian Americans between 18 and 25 drank heavily, although they were considered a low-risk group with alcohol abuse, and that 14% of Asian Americans or Pacific Islanders between 18 to 25 need substance abuse treatment, which is only slightly lower than the 21% average with other groups.
Today, we are lucky enough to have Yvette join us in this conversation. Yvette is a Filipino-American and certified addiction specialist. Yvette works with ADAP, the Asian American Drug Abuse Program dedicated to serving Asian Pacific Islanders and other underserved communities with substance abuse services throughout Los Angeles County. And she's here today with us to share her personal experience with addiction. Welcome to the Asian Boss Girl podcast, Yvette.
Thank you. Yay. I'm so honored. Hi. I'm so honored to be on your podcast. Just because the past podcasts have celebrated women that are of Asian background and all the different and successful things they have accomplished.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Yvette. So we wanted to ask you about your personal experience with addiction, which, like I mentioned earlier, addiction is still so taboo within Asian culture that I think it's going to be really beneficial for our audience to hear your story from whatever perspective it is that you feel comfortable with sharing. So can you share with our listeners how your addiction began?
So there's different types of addiction. Everyone kind of categorizes what kind of addict they are. So I was like all of the addicts. I was like the binger on the weekends when I was younger. And then I became the everyday user to like this devastated my life. I hit rock bottom. A little bit about myself. I, as it was said, come from Filipino parents that migrated to the U.S. to build the American dream. They met in college and had three kids, and me, I was the eldest. Their marriage didn't last that long, and they were divorced by the time I was five. So it was really traumatic for me because my dad was like my best friend and my protector. Hmm. My mom, she remarried soon after that. And I believe she remarried really quick because at the time, a divorced mother with kids carried such a stigma of being a divorcee that she really didn't want to burden herself with that. So I believe she got married really quick because of that. But unfortunately, the man she would marry would be the person that would cause the abuse and terror that me and my siblings would encounter almost daily for years. So from the age of like about 5 to 12, I was physically and sexually molested. And then I think back, for me, like the most traumatic part was the fact that my mom, who is now my protector, wasn't able to even protect herself. So I didn't feel real protected. I remember so many instances where I watched as she was physically beaten by my stepfather, and it was so terrifying. I partied so much during middle school and high school. I guess I started because my mom did end the marriage, and I felt this sense of freedom from this terror. I started with alcohol and pot, and my drug of choice back then was cocaine. But using anything really in my adolescent teenage years to me was so fun and exciting and adventurous. But now I realize why. It was the best way for me to escape any of the feelings and the trauma of the abuse that I endured for years. During those years, people called me the party girl. They called me, they said I was the life of the party. And for me, that was like the best thing to be called because it meant that I was fun and accepted. And during those years, that was what I really wanted, was acceptance, validation from other people, because I was living with so much shame and guilt. And I believe that's one thing that Asian Americans are brought up with a lot of shame and guilt. And for me, that was so prevalent all through growing up because of the abuse that I encountered. And I really think too, in some way, I kind of blamed myself for it, thinking maybe if I shouldn't have been certain places at certain times, maybe it wouldn't have happened to me, but it did. One of the things I really struggled with, and I was called a people pleaser. I wanted everyone to like me and to accept me for who I was because of the shame and guilt that I lived with. While I was using, you know, I built up from alcohol to pot to, of course, then cocaine. I remember one day while we were out partying, I really wanted to get high on cocaine. I couldn't find any. So someone introduced me to methamphetamine, and I was about 23 back then. I really didn't know about meth. I used it and found out very quickly how user-friendly it was. It wasn't like alcohol where the next day you wake up and you have a hangover and you kind of feel guilty about what you did. It wasn't like cocaine where you got a stuffed up nose, you couldn't breathe, and you just felt guilty about using. This was so user-friendly. The next day, all you needed was another hit and you're good to go. And little did I know was that that was just going to take over my life. I mean, 23 years of my life, it would just take over. So I really never thought that I had a problem with substances. Mm-hmm. I went through life through middle school and high school thinking that I was just a party girl and it was okay. Everyone was doing it, but not to the extreme that I was. I was the kind that every weekend I had to be out there using and partying. A lot of my friends, they could only go out like one day a week. I was one day out of the weekend, I was out there all weekend. That was pretty much my life when I was younger. And being Asian, it was so instilled, or being Filipino, it was so instilled to have education as your priority. So I learned how to maintain my grades and maintain my attendance to where, you know, I would graduate. I was so calculating that way. I don't know how I did it, but I was calculating in that manner. So my parents knew that I was quote unquote buck wild, but really couldn't say anything because, you know, I was getting through school. They just thought that, you know, all they really wanted me to do was graduate high school at that point. And when they saw that happening, they were like, okay. And I was able to go on to college, which was, you know, amazing at the rate I was going at the time. So I did complete high school. Everything fell into place. I did complete college. Everything fell into place. And then I went on to nursing school. And nursing school was where I really thought, gosh, if I could do this, I could do anything, because I was using, I was partying, I was being that party girl still. And I did until 2 weeks before I was graduating nursing school. My fiance at the time was found dead in the backyard, shot in the head. Oh my gosh, another traumatic event in my life. But I was able to graduate nursing school, take the boards and pass that. So really everything always just fell into place for me in my life. But the death of my fiance wasn't part of my plan. So what happened after that was me being introduced again to methamphetamine when I was like 23, and I just started using, and I don't know what happened because it was such a whirlwind. And like I said, I just kept using. I didn't think I had a real problem till I was in my late 20s or early 30s. And it was just because the denial was so strong in me. It wasn't until I was unemployed and homeless that I realized that, oh, wow, I guess I do have a problem. But of course, the addict in me minimized that and said, well, you know what? You still have places to sleep, because I was couch surfing and I still had a car and I wasn't on the sidewalk asleep, sleeping on the sidewalk. So my addict mentality thought I was okay. And that was me all the way until I got treatment. So most of my adulthood was using.
I think a lot of people, whether it's with, you know, alcohol or drug use, is always like, it's a very social activity. And you kind of mentioned that, you know, you weren't sure if it's a social thing or if you're addicted. What do you think is or was a source of your addiction? And, you know, what are your thoughts on there being a genetic component to addiction?
So I think the source of my addiction was trying to endure all the feelings, the shame, the embarrassment, the guilt, the anger that I had. While I was growing up, we were never taught to do that. We were never shown that it was okay to have feelings. Basically, all we knew was that we were supposed to go to school, do what we're supposed to do. If my mom ever had to talk to us, it was because we were doing something wrong. If she didn't talk to us, we were doing everything correctly. So I didn't know how to deal with all these feelings. I didn't even know, were they even feelings? I didn't know what was going on. I just knew that it didn't feel good. So I think the source of my addiction was trying to comb through, what was I going through those times? Why was it so appealing to use? And that, I think, when I say it was so exciting to use, it was because I didn't have to feel those feelings of the shame, the embarrassment, the guilt, especially the anger I had, not only towards, and not to say that I had anger towards my mom for allowing this to happen, because she probably, you know, she didn't have any control over it. She was overpowered. Not anger towards my dad, but just anger over the whole situation about what happened, you know, and why was it me? And my faith has a lot to do with my recovery and being able to accept that everything that has happened to me was for a purpose. God had a purpose. And it was so I can be able to share my story. And being a female Asian, we are not to have feelings. We can't show, we aren't brought up to show feelings. We are just to do what we're told. And that was it. Speak when spoken to, and kids too. That's how it is. And I know in my family, I remember growing up, and my mom, we would be going to a family party. My mom would say, when you enter, greet everyone and don't say a word after that. Those are our instructions. Do not say a word after that. Just greet everyone. And that was it. Do not speak unless they ask you a question, and, you know, make sure you do it respectfully. Do not laugh loud. Do not smirk. It was, how do you deal with that? Now the things that I know now, if I wouldn't have known then, like, how was I didn't know what I was feeling. And so my addiction really came from that, because I didn't understand it. No one taught me about feelings. No one taught me about, it's okay to cry and be sad. It was more like, don't cry. There's no reason to cry. You're not dead. Don't cry. Don't laugh so loud. You're a young lady. Just any kind of emotion that went, I guess, there was not even a balance. It was no emotion. And, I think growing up like that is difficult. What were you supposed to do with that? Mm-hmm. And my only coping mechanism, my only coping skill was, I'm going to go use because it makes me feel good. I don't have to feel that. And now I'm being good because I don't feel I don't feel anything, and I don't have to express anything. But I guess I went a little overboard. It lasted 23 years. So I think that was my source of that. And as far as genetic components, so to me, genetics is so intricate and holds so much information about all individuals. And I'm sure there is some connection along the line, but I also know there are possible solutions to any kind of abnormality. So just like any disease, like diabetes, you have a greater risk of acquiring that disease, or like diabetes, if there's a familial history of it. But you can also develop diabetes if you intake too much sugar, or carbohydrates, and your body can't maintain or use the insulin or produce enough insulin. So on the addiction side, if you're exposed to substances that are used as a way to cope for the adult or role models in your life as a child, you may have a greater chance of also developing those same coping skills as well, right? But just like any disease, if there are preventive measures that are taken, it will lessen the chances of developing that disease. So as I'm talking about this, prevention, having information empowers you. Like if you know, hey, diabetes or heart disease is there's a high risk in my family, you kind of learn about it, learn what kind of diet you should be doing, learn how much exercise you should be doing. And with having seen people use substances, being, you know, using alcohol during parties or whatever, maybe you might want to check into that. What are other ways that I could have fun instead of having alcohol at a party? You know, we can do games or whatever. It doesn't necessarily need to be alcohol to have fun. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's other solutions, and just having information like that empowers you to not, you know, go overboard or, you know, acquire a disease.
For sure. For sure. And thank you so much for sharing that story with us, Yvette. Going back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, Asian American parents not really having us express emotion, I think is something that a lot of our listeners and even ourselves here on this podcast, we can definitely side with. It's a lot of showing love through, you know, action and not through words, and telling us not to speak up so loudly and working hard. And it kind of just mutes those emotions from us and can sometimes lead us to things where we can express ourselves, whether it's through some addiction or some type of substance or, you know, alcohol and things like that. And I also just wanted to say that, you know, I think we hear a lot about stories about addiction and about like where people are now, but we don't really hear about the source of it, especially like you mentioned earlier, yours came from abuse because of the shame and the guilt that is the source of all of it, right? So the fact that you are able to share this so openly, I just want to say thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with us.
Almost definitely.
You know, as you were sharing your story, I was curious, you know, at what age were you introduced to substances, and how were you able to hide this from your parents if you did?
So, I was introduced to substances at around 12. Oh, well, okay. So introduced as far as using, but I saw family members, you know, drinking. And yeah, a lot of drinking I saw, especially at parties. Everyone drank. They, you know, drank. And the other thing is gambling. You know, people play mahjong or card games. Yeah. And of course, there was a lot of smoking of cigarettes and drinking. You know, the men would drink. The men always would drink. I always remembered them drinking. And us being Filipino, they would drink and have pulutan, and that's just like drinking and having like little snacks to go with their drink. And then the women would play mahjong, and you know, and sorry, mahjong is also gambling if there's money involved.
That's very true. That's right. Yep. My dad would always say, "Go away, Helen. You can't watch this." And I'd be like, "What's going on? This looks fun." Yeah.
And so, and you know, it was a way too that we would have family parties, and our family parties would last all night long because they would be playing mahjong, and you know, and that's an addiction in itself. I mean, gambling, and I mean, all night long, and they're, you know, playing and whatnot, but it was a way, it was a source, that they had to be able to pay for the party that they were having. Cause they would have, in Filipino culture, it was called balato, where, if someone won, they would put money towards the house. So that would help pay for the party that they were having. So it was accepted. It was acceptable because, you know, they're gambling, but they're also helping whoever was hosting the party pay for the party. So I remember that when I was young. That's how I was introduced to, oh, drinking must be fun. All the adults are doing it.
I see. Yeah.
I think I was in, it was the end of sixth grade. I'll never forget. It was summertime. And we were, one of my friends, we were having a pool party, and someone said they had 7-Up. And now I think back, and they kept going, oh, it's 7 and 7. And I didn't know. And I know I took a big swig, thought it was 7-Up, and it was something else that was awful. And within, I think, 10 or 15 minutes, I felt good. Everything was funny. And that was the first experience I had with using was alcohol. So I was about 11, but then, you know, that was just an experience. Wasn't really something that I took off from. It wasn't until a year after that, when I was in middle school, that drinking was so, it was adventurous, because first of all, to get alcohol, you had to be 21. And so my friends, because I was Asian, and I don't know, I guess Filipinos weren't so known back then. They would dress me up and have me go to the liquor store, and I would go and buy beer. So that was one of the adventures that I would do. And it was, we would buy, I would go in, buy a case of beer, and I couldn't believe I was 12 years old. I had makeup on.
Yeah. And they believe, you know, I mean, I'm assuming you had a fake ID in order to get the beer.
I didn't even have that. And back then, so understand, I'm 54. So this is back a long time ago when people really didn't get in trouble for those things. They didn't, I mean, IDs were, I remember IDs were like paper cardboard things, you know, I don't know. You could probably photocopy. I just remembered back then it was so easy to do so many things. I was buying alcohol at 12. It was just mm-hmm. so that easy. And I'll tell you a funny story. I remember one time I went to the liquor store and they sold me this case, and the case is pretty heavy. It was a case of bottled beer, and they had me in high, my friends put me in high heels and makeup, and I couldn't believe I got away with it. And here I am, 12 years old, running across a field with a case of beer in high heels.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my gosh. And the field was wet. So imagine, the high heels are digging into the grass. It must have been the funniest thing you ever saw, but I was such a kid, and it was the adrenaline and just excitement of it really got me. And I think that's what started my addiction, was just the excitement mm-hmm. of being able to get away with it.
And then how were you able to hide it from your parents once it got, you know, beyond just the alcohol?
So my mom was a single parent because of course she left her husband. And this is when I, you know, felt like I could do whatever I want. I felt like there was no threat for me. It was my mom. She couldn't even protect herself. How is she going to have any control over me? This is just the mindset I was in. I became very rebellious at that age. I would stay the night at my friend's house. She wouldn't know what happened the night before. And then she would come and pick me up, and, you know, I was showered and cleaned up and okay. So she didn't know. I would always find a way to stay the night at a friend's house. And I never told her. I think a couple times I did get caught drunk. She said, you know, she was really mad, tried to ground me. That didn't work because of course, her being a single mom, she worked a lot and I was able just to sneak out. So, I mean, I was really rebellious back then. So I really didn't tell her. She knew there was something going on, but we got to a point to where she said, if you go to school and maintain your grades and get through high school, that's all I want, because, you know, you have to do that. That's just that there's no ands, ifs, or buts. You can't, you know, you can't drop out. You have to go to school. And I was like, okay. You know, and I was so manipulative and calculating back when I was in high school that I learned how to do that. I learned how to, okay, I can miss one day a week and then I won't get expelled. Mm-hmm. I know how to, if I study the night before really well, I can probably get a B and maybe an A on the test, and then I'll be okay. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I just knew how to do things, and everything always fell in the right place when it had to. And I think for me, that was my downfall, was because mm-hmm. I don't know what happened. I don't know what it was. Again, I'm going to say it was God, because it was beyond my control that these things happened with how I was going about my life. And it made it worse, because I made me arrogant, thinking that I can handle whatever. I started using alcohol. I went to pot. I didn't really like it. I didn't really like pot after a while because it just lasted way too long and I didn't have any control over it. And I think that was one of the things too, as part of my addiction, I have control issues. I want to control everything because I didn't have any control when I was younger with the abuse mm-hmm. that I was encountering. Mm-hmm. So it made me have control issues. I always have mm-hmm. to be in control of what I'm doing, and sometimes even would love to control the people around me. And so to me, cocaine gave me that feeling of being in control. It gave me superhuman powers, I thought. Mm-hmm. It was so, that drug was so strong. I was introduced to that at a very early age. I believe I was 14. I just entered high school. Mm-hmm. So it was the way it escalated. It seemed gradual at the time, because when you're young, you know, a year seems like forever. But when I think about it now, how quickly it escalated and just mm-hmm. made me spiral out. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most. And they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, "We see you and we've got you." Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
Skillshare is a sponsor of today's episode. So working in social media, it's constantly changing, and you always need to be sharpening your skills in the art of storytelling, especially through Instagram. A huge shift I'm seeing is the emphasis on video content, whether it's through IG stories or Reels. A class that I have on my radar is Halise Navarez's Video for Instagram, Tell an Engaging Story in Less than a Minute. As a digital storyteller herself, she shares her tips on captivating your audience in 60 seconds. Sounds like a fun challenge for ABG. Skillshare is an online learning community that offers membership with meaning. With so much to explore, real projects to create, and the support of fellow creatives, Skillshare empowers you to accomplish real growth. They have classes on a variety of topics such as film and video, creative writing, graphic design, freelance and entrepreneurship, just to name a few. Every human was born to create. Explore your creativity at skillshare.com/ABG, where our listeners can get a 1 month free trial of premium membership. Again, that's 1 month free of premium membership at skillshare.com/ABG.
Thank you for sharing that, Yvette. Wow. So that is that 23 year long journey. You took us through the journey of how one substance would lead to the next. And listening to your story, it makes sense based on the feelings that you expressed that you were feeling and what, you know, why it kind of escalated. What eventually was it that, you know, made that clicked in your head or that happened and that caused you to seek help?
Let me see. So I really wasn't seeking help. And I'm gonna be very transparent. I was in my addiction for so long. That was my get out of any kind of anything excuse card. If anyone said, "Look at your life," I'd say, "Look at my life. I'm an addict. What do you expect from me? I'm an addict. You know, don't expect me to get a job because I'm an addict. Don't expect me to be responsible because I'm an addict." It became my best friend after a while. I just knew how to say, you know, forget life. I'm just an addict. And actually be so helpless and hopeless and, you know, and really didn't even care about it. As a matter of fact, if I was high, you could judge me. I didn't care. Yeah, I am. And that was my life. So it wasn't until I lived my life in abusive relationships. So all my relationships were abusive only because I needed to, sustain my addiction and my drugs. So I needed to be with someone that could do that for me. And usually that meant, you know, maybe a dealer or someone that had a lot of money that was also using. So they would understand that, you know, I need to use and you're going to help me do this. So those relationships every time will be of one that's filled with domestic violence. So and they usually lasted long for me because meth just, it just, time flies by. Like all of a sudden a year has gone by and that felt like it was just a month. I would be in my relationships for like maybe 10 years at a time. So my very last relationship, I was being abused and I was getting so old. I knew my body couldn't take any more. It couldn't take any more broken ribs. It couldn't take any more black eyes. I couldn't take it anymore. So I gave an ultimatum. I said, you know, this has to stop. I'm calling the police. Because there's, one thing you don't do when you use, you don't ever tell on anyone, because especially if you're telling on the person that's supplying your addiction, that's like automatic death. You don't win anyway. And it's easier to get a black eye or a broken rib than not being able to get high the next day. So you just didn't do that. But I was to my wit's end. And so the man I was with said, "Okay, well, you know what? I swear I won't hurt you anymore. And I'm going to give you a gift. I'm going to give you a puppy." And I got this puppy. So he did keep his word. He didn't hurt me, but I developed this love for this puppy because it was mine. I have had never had kids. I've never been married. I finally had something that was mine that I knew would grow to love me because I would be the mama, you know, the mama puppy, the mom of the puppy. So it turned out that instead of hurting me, he hurt the puppy to hurt me. And that, oh my gosh, and my sister says this all the time, if you would have had kids early on, you probably would have not become such a full-fledged addict, because with just that one time of him hurting my puppy, I said, I'm out of here. This is it. I can't do this. So my sister took me in, and for years, my sister would always look for me, and try to get me help, knowing that, it was my decision to get help. She wasn't going to force me to do it. And she learned this because one of her very good friends, was also, also someone who completed ADAP and got help. And, they introduced her to ADAP, but the one thing they mentioned to her is that I would have to make a conscious decision to want to quit and to want to change. Treatment was not going to work if I was being forced into it. So, you know, my sister came and picked me up from this home that I was being abused in, it or was being abused in, and now my puppy was abused. And she took me in, and I was there for a few days. And she turned around and said, so what are you going to do now? You have a puppy. Like, who's going to take care of your puppy if you're high? And I was like, I don't know, but what am I going to do? I can't leave my puppy. And so, and this, you know, this conversation sounds so elementary, right? But for an addict, it's like anything that you can do and manipulate yourself to get people to do for you, you will. You'll say, I think about it and I'm thinking, wow, how did I think that I was just going to get away with saying something so dumb like that? Like, I was like, I can't leave my puppy. Who's going to take care of my puppy? And then of course the conversation would be like, well, I will take care of your puppy. So we went through this, you know, back and forth, and I was like, you won't take care of my puppy. Yes, I'll take care of you. So anyways, she finally got me to at least say, okay, I'll try to do treatment. And that's how I was introduced to ADAP. My biggest story at ADAP is that my dog saved my life, because if that didn't happen, I probably would never have gotten help, because, you know, it's just me. There was nothing that I really had to live for. I threw away my career. I practically threw away my family. I failed to mention this. I was in my addiction for 23 years. I was so filled with guilt and shame and embarrassment of what I become, because I couldn't support myself. I was, you know, I didn't have anything. I was well into my 30s and 40s. There was a point where I didn't see my family for 5 years, and they didn't know where I was. All they would know is that people would have had seen me somewhere and say, oh yeah, I saw your sister. She's alive. And that's all they had to go by. But, you know, just to let you know, how many times have people seen me? I don't know, maybe once a year, maybe every 6 months, or even that. Imagine, and this is what hurt me the most after I got sober and started to realize the pain that I caused my family, was that they would go months and maybe years of not knowing where I was. And I don't know if you ever watch the news, but a lot of times you'll hear unidentified woman found dead on the side of the road, in a bush, in the mountains or wherever, and unidentified. And immediately my sister would tell me, first thing she would do is pray, please don't let that be my sister. How many times would people after 24 hours haven't heard from their loved one and report them missing? After a week, all of a sudden they have rewards going out, you know, rewards for any information on the person missing. And imagine me missing 5 years, 6 months, 1 year, just them not knowing, and then knowing what kind of lifestyle I was living. How much that hurt. Like, that is, I think about it now, and just having, just, you know, just being empathetic towards the pain that I caused my family is enough to keep me sober today. But I do a lot of other things, so excuse me, sorry.
No, not at all. Thank you so much for sharing that, Yvette. That was very, very powerful to hear. And I could tell how difficult it is to talk about, because it seems like when you're in, you know, the midst of the addiction within those years, you care about your family, but the addiction is just so strong that you can't even, you don't even think about your family until now. You're sort of out of the haze of all of it. And you're like, wow, that was a painful thing to have put my family through it. And thank you for sharing that. I also love how your dog was sort of the reason. Is that your dog in the background that we hear right now?
Yeah, but so the dog that I had, a lot of changes happened for me, and a lot of, I'm going to tell you something about recovery. Recovery is maintenance. It's not that you're cured. It's maintaining yourself so that you have a healthy lifestyle. And I always say this, and I say this to myself every day, I am one thought from relapsing, because that's what that thought will bring me to use, because with every thought, there's always a behavior, right? And so I always have to watch myself. So what happened was, I had to make, there's a lot of decisions you have to make, and they're painful ones sometimes, but then sometimes the most painful ones are the best, you know, are the best. I had to get rid of Smokey, my dog, because I had to move and live somewhere where they did not accept dogs. So, but Smokey, because what I got out of treatment, I started working, I was working a lot, volunteering a lot. I wasn't home enough for Smokey. He really needed to have a playmate and get taken, you know, outdoors and run. So we found him such a good family to live with a big backyard and kids that he can play with. So now he's not stuck in my room waiting for me crying. I remember Smokey, I would go to work and he would sit at my window and howl, and all the neighbors would be like, oh my gosh, she just went to work. And then he would know when I'd come home and he'd be howling again. And they would, everyone knows Smokey's howl in my neighborhood where I used to live. So I'm just so happy and blessed to have found such a good and loving home for him. It was a hard decision, but it was, you know, he's happier now. So that's good. You know, it's inspiring because it was my dog, and I still call him my dog. Like my, just even my Facebook photo has him. It's me and him. He will always be my dog. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. So I just want to say that being in recovery again, it's not, you're not going to ever be cured. Just like diabetes, you'll never be cured. Just like heart disease, you'll never really be cured. You have to maintain your lifestyle. And that's what it takes to be in recovery and be sober.
That is such a powerful statement, Yvette. I think a lot of times people think that once someone is out of recovery, they're completely cured. But like you mentioned, that's not the case. A lot of times for someone who is in recovery, you know, when a negative thought comes into your mind, say you lost your wallet and your ID and you have to go and get another one and replace all your credit cards, or you get a parking ticket or something bad happens at work, the first thought is you go to what's comfortable for you, which is the thing that you did have control over, when it feels like, you know, you're losing control at this moment in your life. So for people who are in recovery, it's like they're in recovery for life. It's not like you go through a treatment center and then you're good. You're back at square one when prior to all of the addiction and substance abuse and things like that. It's like, no, this is something that people deal with for life.
Our coping skills, and that when you're an addict, that's your only coping skill is to use. That's your cure-all. You know, when people start using, it's usually to self-medicate, and then it turns into addiction a lot of times. And so getting treatment, and this is what I didn't realize. This is, you know, in my arrogance, I just really didn't know. I really didn't know what was going on with addiction. And we learn so much all the time. And that's why people who treat people have to constantly recertify or keep up with their continuing education, because things change all the time. And we're learning new things, new tools to provide for clients. So the one thing that I didn't realize was that we have options. Options. Like I didn't really ever understand that. Like, you know, if A doesn't work, you still have B and C and D, but you have to know what those are. And when you're high, you don't have that sense of clarity. So getting just even that little bit of clarity. I know that some people, there's a lot of different types of treatment. I know one thing that people wanted, don't really understand, is harm reduction. And I want to just talk about a little bit about that. So people say, so part of harm reduction is, like, for instance, we tell people how to use safely, and people will question that. Like, why would you teach someone how to use? Well, because again, the addict always feels like no one cares. Like they don't count in society, and they do. And we want to be able to let them know that they do matter. And sometimes just a little bit of safety measures show them that, hey, we do care about you. If you're going to use, let's use safely. So here's some clean needles so you don't mm-hmm. catch Hep C or HIV, or here, use this as like a dental dam over your pipe so that when you're sharing your pipe, or don't share a pipe, we'll give you another one. Or here, put this over the mouthpiece of your pipe so that if someone else is going to use it behind you, they don't catch anything. I mean, just showing a little bit of care sometimes gives someone a sense of clarity about, oh, I do matter to someone, mm-hmm. even if I don't know that person. Mm-hmm. And maybe it is worth my life to maybe get a little bit of help, even if it's going to save me from getting HIV or Hep C. And then from there, you can build from that. Like maybe you can stay sober for one day, you know, like yeah. you can start helping them to commit to something just to help them, you know, help them have a better quality of life. And hopefully they go towards that. Every little, even if it's baby steps, you know, baby steps matter too. It gets you a little closer to something.
Yeah.
Some people, maybe they don't want to stop using because, you know, it's too traumatic for them. But then if they get a sense of clarity, maybe they can learn to get the help they need, you know, through mental health services or medication that can help them not feel so anxious. I mean, there's so many things that we can do, and it might just be baby steps. Through treatment, you learn options. Through wraparound services, you get all that. Like if you go to a treatment facility, they usually have something in place, not only just to get you sober, because once you're sober, what are you going to do after that? They teach you how to prepare a vocation or employment opportunities, help you find housing and get resources so that you can afford to get housing. So it's just not get sober and everything is okay, because it's not all rainbows and unicorns. You'll go through days where, you know, is my only option to use? No, because you'll learn there's other options. And it's really important to know that when you do get treatment, you'll learn how to do that. And they teach you that, and get out of the mindset of, this is the only thing I know, you know, is to use, so I don't have to feel.
Now, I do want to dive into more about addiction in the wider context of Asian culture, which we kind of touched upon earlier. But are there any unique traits or particular trends that maybe you've noticed about addiction within Asian culture, especially with your work with ADAP?
So most Asians, the younger generation, like my generation, there was such a surge in methamphetamine addiction. And I know that it started off as something that they used so that people could work longer hours and whatnot. And because Asians are that way, you know, with school, wanting to always be on top and at the top of their class, or even with working, a lot of like people in the medical field pulling double shifts, working 7 days a week, started seeing a lot of that, like professionals. I've seen and that was one thing that I was so arrogant when I was in my addiction, as far as like trying to get help. I didn't think anyone was like me. I screwed up my life. I was, you know, I know too much. I knew what it would take to become sober, and I wasn't going to do it. No one would know how to treat me or deal with me and getting me to become sober, because no one's like me. You know, I just always felt like that. When I got to ADAP though, there was Asians there, Asians that had careers like me, loving families just like me. You know, it was just that way. Although, but this is how strong addiction is. I'm sitting here, I'm hanging out with, at the time, they even gave us a name, the addicts that all hung out together. It was called the circulation, because we would circulate from city to city in all of Southern California, and just hang out with each other. And everyone kind of had a connection to each other so that we can get our, you know, get our dope, or somewhere to party at and get high at, or someone to hang out with, or, and sometimes even commit criminal activity so that we can, you know, afford to get our drugs and get high. So that was something that I saw a lot of. I saw a lot of, you know, professionals that one day had everything and then the next day lose everything really quick. I started seeing these professionals that had kids, and then sometimes because their addiction would last long, their kids would grow up and they would have kids, and then all of a sudden their kids were using with them. I've seen that. Meth is, and that's a trend that I did see when I was out there. Asian Americans do not necessarily get help. They are the lowest percentage of people who get help for addiction. And knowing that, like in LA, in Los Angeles County, there's such a big population of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and they're not getting help. And I think one of the reasons why is because I don't think Asian Americans understand that the help is available even without insurance, even without being an actual citizen. You can get help without having to pull out money out of your pocket. And that's the one thing that I want to let everyone know, is that there is help out there. ADAP is one of the places where if you need help, you will not get turned away. They will help you. They will find a way to help you without insurance, without even being a citizen, no matter who you are. You don't even have to be Asian American. You can be, you know, you can be Latino from a Latino country. You can be, a European from a European country. It doesn't matter. You can get help. That's the message I really want everyone to know. There is help. There is help. Don't ever think that because you don't have money or insurance, you can't get help. You can. And like I said, I don't care where you're from. If you need, just Google it, search it. There is help. Find someone, or if you know anyone that you think needs help, they can get help.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Yvette. The thing about your story that did resonate with me, and I think a lot of our listeners will find intriguing and potentially can also relate to, is you know, the personality of an overachiever and what that could potentially, what it is like to be in that mindset. And even if they, you know, don't know about addiction or they don't think anyone around them suffers from it, there's a more prevalence in it than you might think. And when you described it in that way, and how within the Asian American community, we have a tendency to not talk about things and we have a tendency to not reach out for help, and how that could potentially even result to a consequence where, you know, grandparents are using with their kids, because a lot of these things, the substances can be a lot more powerful and not within your control, or as much as you'd want to be able to be in control. And you had shared for your particular situation that ADAP was kind of a lifesaver for you. How did you find ADAP, and what was that treatment process like for you?
So again, my sister actually found ADAP through someone who completed the treatment there. And so she got as much information as she can, because again, 23 years, and her just saying, whatever we need to do to help you get sober, we'll do. She had to set a lot of boundaries with me because I was the master manipulator, first of all, just to get my needs fulfilled. I would do anything and everything, say anything and everything just for that day. So today I might just be hungry and need a shower, and I don't have anywhere else to go. My family would be the last place. So it always ended up that way. And my sister would try and find ways, how can I, you know, how can she get me help? And mostly because some of her friends also would have loved ones that were in their addiction. She would tell me, there are several times that she would tell me, yeah, we would get together, have lunch. And then one of them would just tell me, my sister just died, or my brother just died. They found him wherever, dead, overdose, or they found them murdered somewhere because of something, some kind of drug related thing, and it really scared her. So she finally found ADAP, and the person that she knew said that we will always have a bed open for her whenever she's ready. And so it actually took me 5 years to finally go. She kept offering, and I finally went because of Smokey, my puppy. And I already had reservations about going. I thought there's no way they can help me because, mind you, you know, 23 years, I did try to quit, but I had no plan. Like, okay, I'm going to get sober. And then what? I had no plan. I hadn't worked in forever. I haven't really supported myself responsibly or consistently ever. So if I got sober, what would that mean? What would that look like? Well, I know one thing, it would mean that I would have to leave people that I've known for 23 years and I would have nobody. And that sounds lonely. I don't want to do that. Number two, I don't think I'm employable. I haven't had a job in like, you know, 23 years. Everything didn't look right if I got sober. So what was so good about getting sober? So when I got there, I lived at ADAP for 4 months without even unpacking my bags because I was so certain I was going to leave. I was so certain. But ADAP set up as like a micro community. You live there, you eat there, you did everything there. You had a job while you were there. And when I say a job, you had a responsibility that you had to take care of every day, whether it be you were assigned as the person that who coordinated everything that went on at in the residential setting. And the residential setting is usually called a therapeutic community. Or you would be maybe in charge of the kitchen and you were in charge of all the meals that all of the residents ate. There's about 30 of us. So that's a lot of meals and a lot of plates to make sure everyone had filled 3 times a day. Or you were maintenance. That was a lot of rooms that you had to make sure were in proper working order and, you know, other areas of the we call the house or the residential area. Or you were in charge of making sure that the area is maintained, it was clean, that it was livable. So everyone has their job and we were all expected to do our job as best we can with what we had. And sometimes that meant maybe if you were working in the kitchen, you ran out of eggs and what were you going to have for breakfast? You had to figure out how, you know, problem solve that. Real life problems came into play in this little micro community. And this is how we got treatment. Like, how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to deal with people not liking us? And that was my biggest thing. My biggest thing was, you know, I need validation from everyone that I'm liked and likable. And, you know, and that was something I really had to work on. So within this therapeutic community at ADAP, the residential treatment center, you learn to live with 30 different people with 30 different personalities, doing 30 different things, trying to get to the same goal of being productive, being passionate about what they're doing, and living a healthy lifestyle and wanting change. That's so difficult because no one wants to do that. It's not comfortable to change, right? Mm-hmm. And that's treatment. And that was our go-to saying. Whenever we were going through a hard time or someone was complaining about something, we would turn around and say, that's treatment. Mm-hmm. You went through that because you were confined into this little area with these 30 people. There's nowhere to run. You had to face that or leave. You had no choice. So that's why it's really important to make sure that your loved one or someone you know who you want to receive treatment, they have to make up their mind that they want treatment. It's not up to you, the loved one, but what is up to you is to make sure that you have boundaries set so that you don't get hurt in the process or be used or be manipulated into doing things that you really don't want to do. Making sure that they know that it's not them that you don't like. It's, you know, the fact that their addictive behavior is what you don't like, what the addiction is making them do. Because a lot of times addicts feel alone and not loved and they blame themselves. Another thing you can do too is making, if you can, and it's sometimes hard, maybe get an intervention team together that would help in, you know, and letting them realize how is this affecting not only them, but the people that love them, like you. And sometimes, like for me, that's the most compelling for me. And to till this day hurts the most, knowing what I have done to my loved ones and my family throughout, and not actually directly doing anything to them, but just like I said, like them not knowing where I was, knowing that feeling. I remember my mom went on a trip. She flew away somewhere and her plane was late. And just remembering, thinking about, oh my gosh, she's late. She's not here yet. She said she'd be here at 12 and it's now 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Just knowing that feeling. And that was just one day. I can't even imagine going through that year after year after year. Mm-hmm. So just letting them know, you know, that, that this is what it's also doing to us. Sometimes we'll give them some sort of aha moment, like, okay, I know this is just hurting me, but I didn't understand it was hurting everyone else. It helps.
For anyone who's listening, who may be questioning whether they have a problem, what would you recommend that they do? Because you've talked about, you know, maybe using a variety of different substances. But what if, you know, someone, like you said, you start out with drinking and that kind of elevated. What if someone is just drinking alcohol? How do they know, and how would you define whether they have a problem? And what would you recommend that, how would you recommend they kind of go about processing that?
So if you're unsure if you have a problem, you probably have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
People don't wonder if they have a problem unless they have a problem. Is it affecting your day-to-day living? Are you thinking of that? Is that something that you're working your life around, making sure that you have time to drink? Like, are you making sure that you can make happy hour every night because they have drinks for a dollar or whatever? You know, if you're rescheduling yourself so that you can, like I said, for me, the way I knew that I may have a problem was because when I was using, working was getting in the way of me using. So I just quit my job. I thought, you know, I'll go back to working later. I saved enough money. I can go back to working later. Right now, working was getting in the way of me using. If you're calling in sick because, you know, you're hungover, that there's a problem there. A lot of times, too, if you're really questioning and you don't feel like you have a problem, sometimes just going to like an anonymous meeting, either Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, they have Gambling Anonymous, whatever. They have so many different anonymous meetings. You may want to sit in one and see if like the stories resonate with you. And it doesn't even have to be, oh, but I don't use that substance. If you sit there and you're listening to the story and you go, gosh, I feel that way sometimes, mm-hmm. you may have a problem and you may want to get an assessment. ADAP does very good assessments and evaluations. You could just call them and ask for an assessment. And you can find ADAP at www.aadapincadapinc.org. Okay. And they have youth outpatient. They also have outpatient for adults and residential treatment for adults. If you're not from the LA area, they do have other resources. Just give them a call. Give anyone a call. If you feel that you or someone has a problem, would like to find some kind of, you know, treatment modality. And even for someone that knows someone that is suffering from addiction, sometimes you need, you know, to sit in a meeting too and listen to what other people are going through, because an addict's not only hurting themselves, but they also hurt the ones around them, you know. And one of the things that mm-hmm. I used to always say is, you know, don't worry about me. You know, this is my life. I can do it. I never thought about, you know, what are my loved ones really going through when I come over and just eat, take a shower and just sneak out and while they're sleeping and they think they're going to wake up to me and see me and I'm gone, you know, like, mm-hmm. wow, what did I do there? You know? So,
yeah.
So they also needed, you know, to talk to others and just to be able to listen and share their story too helps. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much, Yvette, for sharing how, you know, as a friend or a loved one who is struggling, what are some first steps they could take? What are some additional tips you have for, I guess, for other family members or friends of someone, you know, going through addiction, or how to manage that relationship on how to help them?
Well, first, the way you can really help them is you not enable them. I mean, I know, like I said, most addicts are master manipulators. They will manipulate you into anything, to where if you don't give it, it's because you don't love me. You don't care. Do you want to see me die out here? All I'm asking you for is just $40. Well, you know, $40 is going to buy them a lot. It's going to buy them like maybe 2 or 3 days of being high. And, you know, they will make you feel guilty, make you whatever. You need to not enable them, have boundaries, because addiction just, again, doesn't just affect them, but it affects everyone that's in relation to that person, and they will manipulate you. Another one, another thing too is, you know, letting them know that you do love them or you do care about them, but and it's not them that you're upset about or disappointed about. It's just what the where the addiction is taking them to, and it's hurtful for you. You know, just letting them know that it's not them that you are angry at or not liking or, you know, anything like that, but it's just what the behavior that they have from the addiction. And then another thing is follow through with your consequences. When you say this is the last time I'm giving you $20, make sure that's the last time, because once you don't and you give them the next $20, or this is the last time I'm going to let you come over and take a shower and eat up all the food, and, you know, let that be the last time. This is the last time you can stay the night here, because I can't keep opening up the door at 2 o'clock in the morning. I need to go to work too. Let that be the last time. Set your boundaries. Make sure the you follow through with the consequences so that they know. And that's one thing you, they do seek treatment, that's one thing they will learn about consequences, and learning to use their consequential thinking. If I do this, this is what's going to happen. So make sure you just follow through with those consequences. If you can, also set up an intervention with an intervention team, a professional that can help maybe get the loved one in treatment. That would be good too. That takes a lot of help. It's almost unlikely to be able to do that, because you have to catch up with the person, and sometimes they can sense that you might want to do an intervention. So sometimes that's, you know, something unlikely that can happen, but if you can do it, because you have a professional there and they can, they can help in letting them understand the commitment that they're going to make into going into treatment.
Right.
So just that.
Those are great tips for anyone out there who has a friend or a loved one who is struggling with something. Thank you for sharing that. Now, Yvette, last question for you. For you and for ADAP, what are you focused on personally for Yvette in the near future? And also for ADAP, what is your team focused on? And how can the Asian Boss Girl community support both you and ADAP?
So while I was in treatment, I always wondered, what am I going to do? Because even if I got a job and I clock out and I'm done working, what am I going to do with the time that I'm off of work and the time I go to sleep? That's dead time to me. That is opportunity for me to use. And so I had to find something to do. One of the things I learned to do is run. Oh my gosh, I run marathons. I started this, let me tell you, when I was in my late 40s. I never thought I could do this. So what I'm focusing on in the near future is, I do a lot of fundraising. This is one of my main fundraisers, is I run for our ADAP's marathon program, or AMP. I've been doing this for the last consecutively 5 years. This will be my sixth LA marathon. I usually participate in the LA Conquer Challenge. As a matter of fact, yesterday was one of the first races to do the three races for the LA Conquer. It was the Santa Monica Classic. And I pulled off a personal record. So yay for me. So one of the things everyone can do is to support me in fundraising ADAP to help others who are struggling with addiction. We are able to keep ADAP running and provide services through what we call Drug Medi-Cal. Drug Medi-Cal is like insurance from the state and the county that helps pay for it, but it's not enough. It only pays for the treatment. There's other things that we would like people who are in treatment to be able to experience. Like one of the things is maybe go to the movies. I know when I was in my addiction, I had not seen a movie in a movie theater for over 20 years, you know, and that's probably going to be true now since there's Netflix and everything, but like to go to the movies or to a baseball game. Some of them have never even done that. Some of them have probably never even been to like Magic Mountain or Knott's Berry Farm. I mean, just to be able to enjoy little things like that. Some of them probably never have even been to the beach, even living in Southern California, you know, believe it or not, some people have never even been to the beach. So to be able to do that, it costs money just to drive them there just for transportation, or sometimes even to get pizza and go bowling. Some of them have never been bowling. Some people have never been bowling, just to do that. And that's what the fundraising is for, is to help people who are in treatment do social activities and let them know what, you know, these are the things you can do without using. These are the fun things you can do. Help them do that. You can also donate through ADAP's webpage. Again, it's www.adapinc.org, and you can click on donate and donate there. Okay.
Oh, yay. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Yvette. And congratulations on running the marathon. You had shared with us that you also hit a personal record this past weekend in your training. I think that is such a beautiful thing to take your energy and generate it and focus it in something different. Once again, thank you for being here with us today, Yvette, and being so brave and vulnerable and sharing your story. And for our listeners out there, I know that there are definitely aspects of Yvette's story that you could have related to. If not directly, perhaps you know someone, or maybe some things that she had said sparked something in you. And if you have any questions about, you know, for yourself or for a loved one, please go to aadapinc.org. And again, also please help and donate and support Yvette in running her marathon. I think that is amazing, and support ADAP as well. Once again, that's aadapinc.org. Thanks again, Yvette. And
thank you. So honored again. Thank you so much for having me and having me share my story. I hope I, even if just one person got something from this or is able to share this with a loved one that is suffering from addiction, that's my only hope, is that, you know, my story gets out there and people know that you are not alone and there is help. There's help there. Yeah. Just get it.
Thank you, Yvette. And for all of our Asian Boss Girl listeners, we will catch you all on next week's episode. Bye. Bye.